Welcome to the Day One Podcast. For more information about this weekly program featuring outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Like the man who's really hoping for a kiss at the door when he pays for dinner, or the woman who fights to get her children to church so they will have a moral upbringing, we all too often come before the throne of grace with clear expectations as to how God will meet our needs.
That's the Reverend Jeffrey Hoare. I'm Peter Wallace. Join us for an interesting conversation and a message of faith today on Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now, here's your host, Peter Wallace, to introduce this week's preacher.
Thanks, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're delighted to welcome the Reverend Jeffrey Hoare, who since 1998 has served as rector of All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta, Georgia. A native of England, Jeffrey is a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and earned a master's in theology and religious studies from Cambridge University in England. He also received a Master of Sacred Theology degree from Berkeley Divinity School at Yale University. Jeffrey, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You were with us before in the fall of 2007, and you introduced our listeners to All Saints Church and some of the ministries undertaken on this beautiful campus, which we at Day One are pleased to call our own home base. Your parish website says that All Saints seeks to be an oasis and place of hospitality in the midst of a great city and a university of faith for all who seek a deeper knowledge of God. What are some of the ways the church fulfills those goals?
Well, we have a variety of ministries for all kinds of people, but the most obvious sense in which we are an oasis is the physical setting of gardens and beauty that are maintained by a number of parishioners and volunteers explicitly for the purpose of being a place where people can come from the local offices and sit and have lunch and read a book. And you, I'm sure, have seen many people taking advantage of that. So that's one sense, but there's a greater sense in which we would be a place where you can spend some time in a way that is different than the rest of your life, whether that's in worship or in study or reflection. If you think about it, people spending a couple of hours in conversation about faith is an extraordinary gift to them, as well as an extraordinary offering they're making of their own time, carving out some piece of their lives. Those are the ways in which we would think about being an oasis in a university of faith.
At the same time, the church reaches out to the community to serve various needs very effectively. Tell us about some of those programs.
Well, the longest standing core ministry that we have of that kind is something called Covenant Community, where 16 formerly homeless and drug addicted men live on our campus and go through a 12-step based program of life transformation and engage with the church and parishioners in many ways. We have an extensive ministry of friendship with refugees throughout Atlanta. And in recent years, interestingly, some of those refugees are Christian, and so that has given a different flavor in some ways to our own congregation. We have long-time support for something that used to be housed here and is now further downtown at First Methodist, which is the Midtown Assistance Center for the Working Poor. And we're very proud of our newest ministry, which is now in its sixth year, Threads, a ministry of clothing children with dignity. And this year, we're seeing more people in need, but we're also seeing much needier people in this economy and finding that the demands go way beyond clothing. But we're also been at it long enough to know that we're seeing some people who come back more than once, and we're finding out that those children are, in fact, doing better at school and feeling better about themselves and more hopeful in life as a result of just feeling good about how they look.
Right. One of the many aspects of All Saints' rich ministry in the community is that you bring in outstanding scholars for seminars and lectures. For instance, James Allison, Amy Jill Levine, last December Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan did a presentation on the first Christmas. How do those events enrich the life of your congregation?
Oh, well, they enrich the life of the congregation enormously by providing focus for a broader series of classes. And so, for example, in preparation for Amy Jill Levine's Jewish reading of the parables, she's a Jewish professor of New Testament at Vanderbilt, we had Rabbi Jeff Sulkin came and offered some reflections on how he understands and perceives the Christian faith in relation to his own Jewish faith. And we had Rabbi Benjamin Cohen came and spoke about his year of visiting Christian churches and all in preparation for that lecture. So the lectures become a sort of focal point mm-hmm. for a much broader congregational conversation.
Is the interfaith aspect of much of this seminar and these visiting scholars, is that an intentional goal?
Well, it's something we take advantage of when it is possible, but it's not something that that is true of every person who comes in. I mean, most of our lecturers are Christians talking mm-hmm. about Christian faith, but we did have this opportunity to have Amy Jill Levine here, and so we used that as a way of broadening our perspective. We also attempt to engage consciously in interfaith conversation and are hoping to develop a more meaningful relationship with the Majid, the 14th Street Mosque. We believe that we don't just need to know about Islam, which we can learn about in many ways, but we need to know Muslims and be mm-hmm. friends, mm. and that's our hope.
Last fall, All Saints also received some notice for an unusual ministry in an unlikely place, Cooking Light magazine. Tell us about that.
Ha. Well, that came about out of an interest in a ministry we have called eCare, developed a few years ago by a number of parishioners and a priest who was on staff at the time, as an attempt to use the web for pastoral care ministries. And a large part of what that ministry is about is a community of prayer. So everyone who makes a prayer request receives some sort of pastoral response from one of the clergy and gets assured of a community holding that person in prayer. But there are also practical needs that get met. So if someone's sick or just home from the hospital or has a new baby, then we would normally deliver a meal and the group gets together from time to time to cook. Mm-hmm. And Cooking Light came and interviewed the group while they were cooking. The irony is that the one thing the meal is not is light. So we're hoping to interest gourmet next time.
Okay. Well, we turn from physical to spiritual nourishment with your sermon for today. This Sunday is the last Sunday after the Epiphany, and the church observes the transfiguration of Christ described in Mark chapter 9. But your sermon draws mostly from the psalm for today, Psalm 50. Would you read that for us?
Certainly. A portion of Psalm 50. Our God comes and does not keep silence. Before him is a devouring fire and a mighty tempest all around him. He calls to the heavens above and to the earth that he may judge his people. Gather to me my faithful ones who made a covenant to me by sacrifice. The heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge.
This gives us a rather bright and noisy image of God. What do you make of this description of God?
Well, we're talking about the ways in which God is made manifest in epiphanies or manifestations. And so today we'll hear about Elijah being taken up by a whirlwind, and we'll hear about Jesus being transfigured, which is not such a noisy manifestation. We'll recall, of course, the still small voice and recognize that God is made manifest in many, many ways. The question is, why? Hmm. And that's what I hope to address in the sermon.
Well, Jeffrey, we look forward to hearing more about the answer to the why. Your sermon is entitled Epiphanies. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. In any congregation of Christians, there are some people who can say they have been blessed with an epiphany, a powerful manifestation or experience of God. There are many more people who fervently wish that such a gift would be granted them, and who imagine that if only they could have a conversion or they could have a mountaintop experience, then their faith would not be so difficult. They imagine that belief would be easier to come by if they could be as clear as they imagine those around them to be. And then there are yet others who have moved beyond any hope or expectation of such epiphanies in their lives, rather in the spirit of what Jesus once said to Thomas, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." The scriptures appointed for today are filled with epiphanies and commentary upon them. We see Elijah ascending in a whirlwind into heaven. We see Jesus transfigured on a mountain in the presence of Peter and James and John. We have Paul reminding the Corinthians that it is God who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. But it is in the opening verses of the 50th Psalm that we get some help, some clues about epiphanies, wherever we find ourselves in relation to such things. The psalm begins praising a glorious manifestation of God who does not keep silent, but shines forth with a devouring fire going before and a mighty tempest all around. This manifestation is not an end in itself. It is given for the purpose of judgment and renewal of the people whose covenant was made and expressed in acts of worship. Years ago, I was whining to a wise monk, a man now in his 90s, about how dull and fruitless and boring my prayer and my worship seemed to be. He pointed out to me that I was looking for the effects of my prayer and worship in the actions themselves. I was looking for some kind of experience of God, some kind of manifestation of God, some powerful sense of God's presence. I was trying to conjure one by my devotion, or engender an epiphany by the fervency with which I sang, or a sense of wonder that I was able to find as I approached communion. He told me I was missing the point. I should rather be looking for the effects of my prayer in my life, he said, and not in the prayer itself. Of course. The monk was right. I was praying not as a way of living into righteousness or right relationship, but as a means to an end. I was like the man who's really hoping for a kiss at the door when he pays for dinner, or the woman who fights to get her children to church so they will have a moral upbringing. All too often, we come before the throne of grace with clear expectations as to how God will meet our needs. Some people complain that they don't get anything out of worship. They say they're looking for the effects of the worship in the worship itself and not in their lives. I was bored because I was an adventurer and a thrill seeker. I wanted that powerful experience of God, and I wasn't really looking for judgment or transformation or renewal. Talk about judgment. That monk's wise words were judgment for me. I had it all wrong. We look for the effects of right worship in our lives, for we are changed as we do what we're supposed to do in worship. When we worship, we orient ourselves toward that which is of true and ultimate worth. Or put another way, we turn anew toward God each week. We turn toward the light as we hear again and act out and respond to the story of our faith. And somehow, in that experience, we are shaped and transformed and renewed by God in ways that we might not even notice. But in time, we can find ourselves living less anxiously and more freely through our regular practice of worship. And if we stop worshipping, we will find our anxiety increasing and our freedom diminishing. Any sense of immediate experience of God is a gift. It's an unmerited, undeserved, unpredictable gift of God's abundant grace, just in the same way that the ways in which we are shaped by our turning toward what is of ultimate worth is itself a gift. It's simply what happens in real and right relationship with God. As the psalmist would have it, the heavens declare his righteousness. Members of congregations are not alone in having misguided expectations of prayer and worship. Clergy, musicians, and other leaders of worship sometimes spend their time trying to create or design what they call a powerful worship experience, something that will move or convict the people of God's might and majesty and power. The theologian James Allison has written about this kind of worship designed to create an experience as what he calls Nuremberg worship. He's referring to the rallies that took place in Nazi Germany leading up to the Second World War. He acknowledges that he could have used football matches, celebrity cults, raves, initiation hazing, newspaper sales techniques, and so on. He says that the organizers of Nuremberg worship knew exactly what they were doing and did it remarkably well. As he puts it, "You bring people together and you unite them in worship. You provide regular rhythmic music and marching. You enable them to see many people in uniform, people who have already lost a certain individuality and become symbols. You give them songs to sing. You build them up with the reason for their togetherness, a reason based on common racial heritage. You inflame them with tales of past woe and reminders of past confusion when they were caused to suffer by some shame being imposed upon them, the tail end of which woe is still in their midst. You keep them waiting and the pressure building up. All this gradually serves to bring people out of themselves, the normally restrained becoming passionate, unfriendly neighbours finding themselves looking at each other anew in the light of the growing Bruderschaft. Then, after the build-up, the Führer appears, and before long the apotheosis takes place. He and he is in their midst. With a few deft gestures, he conjures up the mood of those present." From here, Allison describes how the crowd or congregation get whipped up into delirium, and the Führer is even able to thank God for allowing him to give his life, working tirelessly in service of the people. And they, not any other, are the people, the Volk. Later, Allison suggests, on their way home perhaps, the people look at each other, and anyone who might be an outsider, the Jew, the Gypsy, the Black and the homosexual, in a slightly different light. So says our theologian, "To the divinization of one, there corresponds the demonization of the other, which is the dehumanization of all." This is incredible stuff, and a real judgment on all those who would create a powerful worship experience. Real worship, you see, is not a creation of a Volk, a folk, a people, but rather a reminder of our common humanity. Real worship is not the story of how we have been victimized or the recitation of some grievance, but the story of one who is victimized by us and who wants us to see the truth about ourselves. Real worship is judgment and renewal, just as the psalmist saw when God was made manifest in fire and tempest. Real worship happens when we once again turn our lives toward the one that really matters, that which is of ultimate worth, and allow that to shape our interactions and relationships in ways of which we can never be fully aware. That is God's grace, with or without a powerful and momentary experience. Many people who get caught up in Nuremberg worship do find a measure of salvation. For God desires to use all things for good, even lest we forget the cross of Christ. I was one of those souls, granted a powerful experience of God's grace. It probably wasn't manipulated, but it was earnestly desired by the leaders of the occasion that I would call my conversion. I was granted a sense of belonging and a sense of identity, and I wanted to share it with everybody around me. I became quite a successful teenaged evangelist of other teenagers, selling the Nuremberg identity to others who would know that they were the chosen while others might not be. And how we longed for the football players and the popular students and the chaplains and the headmaster to know what we knew and to give their lives to what we mistakenly thought was Christ, but was in fact a human creation, one that made us feel beloved and worthwhile, but a human creation nonetheless. We attributed all this, of course, to the grace of God. What changed for me was the experience of a real congregation, or real people who were being formed in the story of our faith and shaped by what is of ultimate worth week in and week out their whole lives long. Sometimes the worship was glorious, sometimes spare, often engaging, sometimes dull. A number of my friends, tainted by that early experience of Nuremberg worship, fell by the wayside and rejected the way of faith altogether. But I was granted real grace in the midst of a real congregation, in the midst of regular, ongoing gathering for worship. In retrospect, this was a powerful experience of God, but neither the one I sought nor the one I expected, as I made a transition to a new way of being faithful in the midst of the people of God, all of whom were being transformed in God's grace, and among whom, at best, there were no others, no outsiders, or people who fell into any of the ways we categorize each other to make ourselves feel superior or blessed or special in the sight of God. Our God comes and does not keep silence. Before him is a devouring fire and a mighty tempest all around him. He calls to the heavens above and to the earth that he may judge his people. Gather to me my faithful ones, who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. The heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Now let's rejoin our host, Peter Wallace, and Jeffrey Hoar for some final thoughts on this week's message.
Jeffrey, thank you for a very powerful sermon. You started by commenting on the desire of many believers who fervently wish for an epiphany, a powerful experience of God, which they believe would increase their faith, take them to a higher spiritual level. And the Bible is filled with such epiphanies. So is it wrong to want to experience a powerful epiphany in our own lives?
Oh, I don't think it's wrong to want to experience one at all. I think it's worth asking why we want one. I remember at one point praying that I would have my eyesight made perfect so I wouldn't have to wear glasses. And I realized in time not only that I didn't mind wearing glasses, but also that what I was really doing was putting God to the test. In other words, I was not looking for relationship with God as much as I was looking for God to do a trick. And similarly, when I talked about my own prayer life, I was looking for that powerful experience. I don't think there's anything wrong with asking God to bless us with those gifts and to accept them as gifts, which they are when we're granted them.
And as you pointed out, the problem is that we try to conjure up or force such experiences, whether by ourselves or by opening ourselves to manipulative emotional worship experiences. You said that misses the point. Such spiritual experiences are not intended as ends in themselves, which is how many often consider them. Would you say more about the proper ends that we should pursue?
Well, the ends that we're pursuing are living into the promises of God that we can be free and forgiven and know ourselves loved and be in right relation with God and each other and with the whole of creation. And that can take, I'm sure, various different forms. So when we are granted an powerful experience of God's presence, for example, what does that mean to us? It might be reassurance in a difficult time, or it might be encouragement, or it might be simply a gift of joy. And then how we respond to it matters. You remember the story of the 10 people who were healed and only one said thank you. And the proper end, it seems to me, is the relationship and not simply the effect, the immediate effect.
You quoted theologian James Allison's provocative description of the spiritual and emotional manipulation that some clergy and worship leaders employ to lead people into these artificial epiphanies. He called it Nuremberg worship, and it leads, as he put it, to the divinization of one and the demonization of the other, which is the dehumanization of all. We can see examples of this in many religious environments today. The problem is, when one is involved in such a situation, it's difficult to realize what's happening because it feels so right. What should believers do to be aware of this phenomenon?
I don't know that there are any particular shoulds, but I can say that I think that a primary place where it gets challenged is in the sacrament of communion, the Lord's Supper, Eucharist, the Mass, where we are all equally confronted by the one we have made a victim, who bore the sin of the world, and who, in the act of forgiving us, begins to invite us to live in a different way. So my counsel, if you like, when we wish to become more aware of this, is to say our prayers and to join with the community around the Lord's table and receive whatever gifts are prepared for us to receive.
Jeffrey, what's the one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind this week?
I hope that those who are blessed with an experience of God's grace will give thanks, and that everyone will continue to be and do what it is to be faithful, to gather with others in worship, orienting ourselves toward that which is of ultimate worth, and trusting that God desires that we be more free, less anxious, more charitable, more filled with love, and able to live with a spirit of gratitude.
Jeffrey Hoare, thank you for being with us. We look forward to having you back next week.
Thank you for your kind invitation.
Day One brings you preachers from the Episcopal Church, the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Church of Christ, and the United Methodist Church. Donald Jones is our production supervisor and audio engineer, and Peter Wallace, our executive producer. It's been our joy to bring you today's program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever. For the past 6 years, Day One has been proud to sponsor the Festival of Homiletics, the acclaimed conference that last year drew more than 2,000 preachers from across North America and beyond. If you're a pastor, youth leader, or teacher, or hope to be, you owe it to yourself and to those you serve to attend the 2009 festival, May 18th through the 22nd in Atlanta, Georgia. Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Barbara Brown Taylor will be the special honorees. You're sure to enjoy and benefit from the sermons, lectures, and worship services with some of the best known and most admired preachers of our time, many of whom you've heard on Day One. For more information, visit goodpreacher.com or call 1-800-866-8631. This year, experience the Festival of Homiletics and discover what a difference it can make in your life and ministry.